is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken delivered some of the Biden administration's strongest public criticism yet of Israel's conduct of the war in Gaza. America's top diplomat said in two television interviews that Israeli tactics have meant a horrible loss of life of innocent civilians, but have failed to neutralize Hamas leaders and fighters and could drive a lasting insurgency. He underscored that the United States believes Israeli forces should get out of Gaza, but also is waiting to see credible plans from Israel for security and governance in the territory after the war. Israel Sunday pushed deeper into southern Gaza's Rafah and battles of regrouping Hamas in northern Gaza. AP correspondent Karen Chamas.
Heavy bombardment was reported overnight in Jabalia and other areas in northern Gaza. Residents said Israeli warplanes and artillery struck across the camp and the Zeytun area east of Gaza City. The north has been largely isolated by Israeli forces for months. UN officials say there's a full-blown famine there. Just a day earlier, in central Gaza, families gathered around the bodies of loved ones after over a dozen people were killed by Israeli strikes. I'm Karen Chamas.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has now changed his defense minister.
The Russian president has replaced Sergei Shoigu as defense minister in a cabinet shakeup. In line with Russian law, the entire Russian cabinet resigned following Putin's inauguration at the Kremlin, and most members had been widely expected to keep their jobs. Putin signed a decree on Sunday appointing Shoigu as secretary of Russia's National Security Council, the Kremlin said. The appointment was announced shortly after Putin proposed another man to become the country's defense minister. Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
And this is VOA News. Pope Francis on Sunday renewed his appeal for a general exchange of all prisoners between Russia and Ukraine, opening again the Holy See support for that mission.
Rinnovo il mio appello per uno scambio generale di tutti.
Speaking from his window overlooking St. Peter's Square, and the Pope assured all parties involved in the Russian-Ukrainian conflict that the Holy See remains ready to facilitate every effort in this regard, especially for those who are seriously wounded and sick. Francis also renewed his constant appeal for peace in other war-torn countries, including the Middle East. He said, "Let us continue to pray for peace in Ukraine and Palestine and Israel and Myanmar. Let us pray for peace," he concluded. Another prosecution star witness in Donald Trump's hush money trial is about to take the stand. AP correspondent Julie Walker.
He once said he'd take a bullet for Donald Trump. Now his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, is going to testify against the former president in his hush money trial. Cohen paid Stormy Daniels $130,000 to keep quiet about what she testified to as a sex encounter with Trump, which he denies. Prosecutors say the crime was Trump reimbursing Cohen for the hush money. Trump denies this and at a campaign event Saturday said the case is politically motivated.
I'm being forced to endure a Biden show trial, all done by Biden.
Cohen expected on the stand Monday. Julie Walker, New York.
A strong earthquake shocked the border of Mexico and Guatemala early Sunday, driving frightened residents into the streets. The trembler struck just before 6 a.m. near the Mexican border town, where a river by the same name divides the two countries. The epicenter was just off the Pacific coast, 10 miles west-southwest, where the river empties into the sea. The controlled demolition of the largest remaining steel span of the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, Maryland, has been postponed because of weather conditions. The explosives are now expected to be detonated Monday evening. The steel span landed on the bow of a massive container ship that lost power and crashed into one of the bridge's support columns shortly after leaving Baltimore March 26th. Since then, the ship has been stuck. The wreckage in Baltimore's busy port has been closed to most maritime traffic. The controlled demolition will allow the ship Dolly to be refloated and restore traffic through that port. You'll find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
shuts down Al Jazeera, raids their offices.
We strongly condemn the and denounce this criminal act that violates human rights.
Thousands of Hungarians protest against nationalist Prime Minister Viktor Orban. And baking the world's longest baguette.
And with a great, huge record to beat of 132.63 meters, I can confirm that this attempt has been successful.
Today is Monday, May 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Israel has closed and raided Al Jazeera's offices in Israel, confiscated its broadcast equipment, cut off the channel from cable and satellite companies transmitting in Israel, and has blocked its websites. The Israeli government says Al Jazeera will be shut down as long as the war continues. Al Jazeera's Arabic managing editor, Mohammed Mawad.
We strongly condemn the and denounce this criminal act that violates human rights and the basic right to access of information. Al Jazeera affirms its right to continue to provide news and information to its global audiences.
Elad Omari is Al Jazeera's bureau chief in Israel and the Palestinian territories.
Israel cannot claim all the time that she's a democracy, that it's democracy, and at the same time they are cutting and prevent the journalists to do their job.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He's saying Al Jazeera reporters have harmed Israel's security and it's time to remove, quote, the mouthpiece of Hamas from our country. Al Jazeera said it will pursue legal action. Joining us now to talk about this is Professor Joseph Russomanno from Arizona State University's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication. So Israel had passed this that allowed them to do this, so it's not a total surprise that they're shutting Al Jazeera down, but it is still concerning, no?
Oh, absolutely. Any pretense of advocating and believing in a free press runs 100% counter to this.
It's the point that Al Jazeera themselves made. It's hard to run around telling everyone you're a democracy when you're shutting down an entire news channel.
Well, and I don't think that is an invalid assessment by any means. You know, there is the old axiom that a autocratic leader or nation, among the first things they go for is the press, and to try to control the press or some aspect of the press so that they can control the information that the citizenry obtains. And so this seems to be at least a page from that playbook.
This kind of thing has what effect, generally speaking? If we pull back a little bit, its effect on the population that the government serves.
Right. You know, and I guess in many respects, I am compelled to compare it to the American model. We would never see this sort of thing happening in the United States because of our First Amendment and the way that our courts have interpreted the First Amendment. And what it does first and foremost is prevents the government from doing this very sort of thing to the news media in general, to the media in general, or to any particular organization that may fall out of favor with the government. And that seems to be exactly what's happening here. So to the point of your question, I have to think that if nothing else, this is another governmental move that erodes the faith and trust that the citizenry of Israel would have in its own government.
What else should we be thinking about when we see something like this happen?
Well, you know, while I a moment ago invoked the American comparison and the quote, "it could never happen here," unquote, fallback position, I think it behooves us, it is beneficial for all of us to consider the fact that maybe it could. You know, under certain circumstances, these sorts of things could be in the offing, and it is just a very, very dangerous situation when we as citizens are deprived of any information. I mean, the whole idea behind, you know, our First Amendment or any freedom of press-based commitment is that the citizens are, by and large, savvy enough, smart enough, and rational enough to be able to absorb any information that is provided to them, sort out the good from the bad, the right from the wrong, and make their own decisions. That is what a democracy is about. And when that is taken away, as we suggested earlier, then you start eroding at the foundation of a democratic society.
Thank you. Thank you so very much for your time.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Professor Joseph Russomanno from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Arizona State University. Israel's shutdown of Al Jazeera coincided with World Press Freedom Weekend. World Press Freedom Day was this past Friday. There is a trend of press freedom crackdown all over the world, including here in the United States. The latest global press freedom rankings from the media watchdog Reporters Without Borders present a discouraging picture, including a lack of political will to defend a free press. For VOA, Christina Cacedo-Smith has the story.
U.S. President Joe Biden was direct in his message late last month to Russian President Vladimir Putin about the country's detention of two American journalists, Ivan Koshkovich and Altsu Kurmasheva.
Journalism is clearly not a crime, not here, not there, not anywhere in the world.
But as the cases of Koshkovich and Kurmasheva show, media are at risk. Media watchdog Reporters Without Borders echoes this sentiment in its newly released 2024 Press Freedom Index, which finds that threats from governments are the biggest challenge to journalism. Moscow's tight grip on media since its invasion of Ukraine keeps Russia low on the index. Censorship and threats of legal action have prompted the exile of more than 1,500 of its journalists since February 24, 2022, according to Reporters Without Borders, or RSF.
The free press is a thing of the past in Russia. It is virtually impossible to operate openly as an independent journalist in Russia.
At the Washington National Press Club, President Emily Wilkins says the rising risk should be a concern to everyone.
We have seen journalists being murdered for their work in previous years. We've seen a number of other harassments, threats made to reporters. And so I think on the whole, there is a rising concern about press freedom, both in the U.S. and abroad.
In the U.S., a police raid of a Kansas newsroom, hostile rhetoric and arrest of journalists covering protests led to the country's dropping 10 places in the 2024 index.
There seems to be this growing culture of acceptability or permissibility towards attacking the media. And we see it especially at the local level. We see local politicians railing against their local newsrooms and their local journalists. We see local law enforcement carrying out pretty shocking actions against local reporters.
Argentina, Peru, and El Salvador also saw declines. In those countries, says RSF, political pressure and an environment hostile to journalists are common. Afghanistan fell 26 places to the third worst in the world for press freedom. Taliban directives on media and women make it increasingly hard to work there, say journalists. China, too, remains near the bottom, and its influence is spreading, says RSF. In Hong Kong, pro-democracy publisher Jimmy Lai is on trial under the national security law introduced by Beijing. He faces life in prison if convicted.
We're very concerned that China is setting itself up as an export model for anti-democratic values that clamp down on press freedom and freedom of speech.
With dozens of countries due to hold elections this year, RSF says the decline in political actors coming to the defense of press freedom is a troubling trend. Even Norway and Ireland, which have historically good records, saw a drop in the rankings. Cristina Caicedo-Smith, VOA News.
Hope diminished in Cairo at the ceasefire talks between Israel and Hamas. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Sunday flat out rejected what he said were Hamas's demands for a potential truce. Prime Minister Netanyahu said the Palestinian Islamist group wanted the removal of all Israeli forces from Gaza and a permanent end to the fighting, leaving Hamas in power. At a Holocaust Remembrance Day event, Netanyahu said,
I say to the leaders of the world, no amount of pressure, no decision by any international forum will stop Israel from defending itself. As the Prime Minister of Israel, the one and only Jewish state, I pledge here today from Jerusalem on this Holocaust Remembrance Day, if Israel is forced to stand alone, Israel will stand alone.
Hamas, meanwhile, blamed Israel for the impasse. In a statement, the chief of Hamas accused Netanyahu of sabotaging efforts made through the mediators. Hamas is a U.S.-designated terrorist group. Israel closed its main crossing point for delivering badly needed humanitarian aid for Gaza after they say Hamas attacked it. Hamas claimed responsibility for the attack. Israel's military says 10 projectiles were launched from Rafah in southern Gaza toward the area of the crossing, which it said was now closed to aid trucks going into the enclave. We're following these other stories from around the world. The parents of an American and two Australian surfers presumed to have been killed in northern Mexico have arrived in the country and will try to identify the bodies believed to be their sons. Police found three bodies in a well and are conducting forensic tests. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken will travel to Guatemala on Tuesday to lead a delegation to the ministerial meeting of the Los Angeles Declaration on Migration and Protection. They'll be discussing enforcement, migration management, and refugee integration. The number of people killed by flooding and other impacts of the heavy rains that have been just battering Kenya has now risen to 228. According to the Interior Ministry, the torrential rains that have caused widespread flooding and landslides across the country in recent weeks are forecast to get even worse in May. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, despite the fact that their encampments at university campuses have been dismantled, pro-Palestinian demonstrators in the United States are standing their ground. If the protests continue, some analysts say they could have an impact on the 2024 presidential election. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias explains.
Over 20 pro-Palestinian demonstrators were arrested by police and saw their encampment forcefully dismantled Saturday at the University of Virginia. But scenes like this don't seem to discourage the protesters, many of whom have already taken their demands to their graduation ceremonies in states like Michigan. After Tuesday's police clearing of a building that had been taken over by protesters at Columbia University, New York City Mayor Eric Adams appeared Sunday on ABC's This Week show. He said law enforcement will ensure calm prevails during the graduation ceremonies.
We will do our job, and if the institutions decide to graduate their students and celebrate a beautiful experience with their families, we will make sure it's done in a peaceful manner.
President Joe Biden addressed the protests Thursday, And his re-election campaign co-chair, Mitch Landrieu, appeared Sunday on CNN's State of the Union to underscore Biden's core message.
Everybody has a right to protest, but they have to protest peacefully. If they're protesting violently, that has to end. There's no place for that. There's no place for anti-Semitism. There's no place for Islamophobia.
On his part, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump, renewed his criticism of the pro-Palestinian demonstration Sunday. He posted on his Truth social media platform that Biden is, quote, the primary reason for all these terrible protests. It's a political strategy that Trump is using to support his own re-election bid, says political scientist Michael Traugott.
And he wants them to stop. He wants protesters, including students, to be arrested and removed from campus. But he doesn't understand, or he doesn't want to acknowledge, that the president has little direct control over any of this.
If they continue, however, the protests could have an impact on the November election, Traugott says.
I think the protests generally do favor Donald Trump because they are contrary to the views of a large portion of his supporters. And they would be more likely to turn out, while on the other hand, they could depress turnout among young people, mostly Democratic, who would support Joe Biden.
It is expected that President Biden will talk about efforts to combat anti-Semitism when he gives a keynote speech on Tuesday at the Holocaust Museum. Trump's week will also be busy with courtroom appearances related to his criminal trial in New York and preparations for a new campaign rally in New Jersey on May 11th. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Panama's former security minister, Jose Raul Malino, built a commanding lead in the country's presidential election. At the time of the show, not all of the votes had yet been counted. Chadians go to the poll on Monday, 3 years after their military leader seized power in the first presidential election in Africa's Sahel region since a wave of coups. Thousands of Hungarians protested against nationalist Prime Minister Viktor Orban at a rally on Sunday, weeks ahead of the European Parliament and local elections due in early June. Peter Magyar, a former government insider, seen by some observers as the first serious threat in years to Orban, staged the rally attended by about 10,000 people in the eastern town of Debrecen, a stronghold of the ruling Fidesz party. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. It's been a year since supporters of former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan stormed the military to protest his arrest. Human rights proponents say political repression in Pakistan has increased over the past year. VOA Pakistan Bureau Chief Sarah Zaman has the details.
On a recent April morning, Fahmida Farooq traveled for hours to come to the Supreme Court of Pakistan. Her son, Fahim Haider, has been in military custody for nearly a year.
It's been terrible. I can't explain.
In October, a 5-judge bench of the top court halted the military trials of the accused civilians, saying the move was unconstitutional. The government quickly challenged that decision. In December, a 6-member bench of the Supreme Court allowed the military trials to resume. The legal flip-flop has frustrated families.
I am surviving and going to courts with this feeling that the law and the constitution have become irrelevant in Pakistan.
Haris Khalik, Secretary General of the Independent Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, says military trials are just one example of increased repression in Pakistan since the violence last May. Former Premier Khan has been jailed since August. There's a de facto ban on saying his name in mainstream media. Freedom Network, a Pakistani media watchdog, says curbs on dissent have increased as a February ban on social media platform X continues and journalists are under investigation for allegedly maligning government officials. Pakistan's Ministry of Interior said it suspended X to maintain peace after February's parliamentary elections, in which Khan's party complained of irregularities.
This is Jinnah House, the official residence of the Corps Commander of Lahore, a very senior army officer. And this is one of the military properties that were badly damaged in the violence on May 9th last year. Now, earlier this April, the military released 20 people who were charged with violence last year, but were sentenced for up to a year. The fate of those remaining in military custody is unclear.
Yeah, so that is there. But otherwise, we are a very angry and a very tired lot.
State authorities have repeatedly called May 9, 2023 a dark day, promising punishment for perpetrators. Dozens of families are still fighting for an open trial for loved ones taken into military custody a year ago. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Lahore, Pakistan.
And finally, French bakers cooked the world's longest baguette on Sunday. It measured 140.53 meters.
The final measurement is taken by the length of the baguette, and with a great huge record to beat of 132.63 meters, I can confirm that this attempt has been successful. I would like to congratulate you on setting this Guinness World Records title for the longest baguette at 140 meters, 140.534 meters.
That's long enough to reclaim the record for one of France's best-known emblems, which has been held by Italy for the last 5 years. Part of the baguette was cut and shared with the public. The rest was to be given to the homeless. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for being with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Positive steps toward quelling the violence and chaos in Haiti were taken in late April when the Transitional Presidential Council was sworn into power at the National Palace in Port-au-Prince. The installation of the Transitional Presidential Council is a very important step for Haiti's path toward democratic governance, new elections, and improved security, said U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs Brian Nichols.
This group embodies a broad consensus of Haitian society in favor of a new path forward. It's the outcome of months of negotiations among a very broad group of stakeholders, and I think this is a very, very positive moment.
The council was tasked with appointing a new prime minister, cabinet, and an electoral council that will prepare the country for general elections in February 2026. The move paves the way for the deployment to Haiti of a Kenyan-led multinational United Nations Security Support Force to help Haiti's national police deal with horrific gang violence. Assistant Secretary Nichols pointed out that the strength of Haitian gangs has been building for years.
Haitian society has not been able to deliver the kind of opportunities for young people, jobs, education that it needs. At the same time, the state in Haiti has been fragile for many years. With the departure of the UN peacekeeping mission MINUSTAH, the security profile in Haiti began to weaken, and gang violence, which has been a problem in significant measure since the 1990s, really started to grow. And then with the tragic assassination of President Moïse in July 2021, we saw the weakness of the state really in stark relief.
Assistant Secretary Nichols said, "We hope that improved security with the presence of the Multinational Security Support Mission and strengthening the Haitian National Police, coupled with intensive action in terms of economic development, gang diversion programs, refocusing on education and services in the most vulnerable areas, will help help both address the immediate problem of crime while preventing more youth from entering into gang activity. The United States is the largest provider of assistance to Haiti, noted Assistant Secretary Nichols. But other countries and international organizations also need to step forward and provide assistance, he said. This is a global responsibility, not just the United States' responsibility.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the